much better. Hey, folks. Welcome again to another edition of Liberty Unbridled. The music is still broken on Blog Talk here, so it won't turn down, so we just turn it off. Got a lighter show this week. The last 2 weeks have been just crushing through news, just so much going on that it's been absolutely brutal to just get through all the news, much less have any commentary to give any thoughts or to take a breath, really, half the time. But I guess I should start out. If you're interested in calling into the show tonight, the number is area code 858-683-1326, 858-683-1326. And, of course, if you'd like to talk, you have to press the 1 button so that I know that you want to talk. So I guess one of the things I wanted to talk about to start out, so my son graduated from high school yesterday, and it's been kind of a whirlwind here the past 24 hours or so with all the events and whatnot going on around that. And I've been I'm a little tired as a result, so it's going to be a slower pace show. We have less news. I'm tired. And that's okay. We could definitely use a slower paced show after the last couple of weeks. But so my son did graduate from high school yesterday officially, and of course we're happy about that. And perhaps you know, the timing was no accident, but there's a article that came out looks like last week or no today. Sorry, today. That a third of millennials regret going to college. And essentially, what this is all about are the kids that are paying way too much to go to school to get a degree, getting out of school, and not being able to get a job, or not being able to get a job that pays well enough to ever pay off the college loan. And, you know, that's a problem. We've got a generation of kids coming out of school that all have degrees, that are entering the job market when the job market is poor, and they, you know, you can rack up, I mean, even Northern Kentucky University here, I believe, is $9,500 a year, I think. Maybe it's 9, maybe it's 10, somewhere in there. So you're talking local state school here in Kentucky is going to run you anywhere between $40,000 and $50,000 to get a degree. And if you're, you know, taking out loans to subsidize that, it's going to be interesting, to say the least, to get a job in this job market. And, boy, I have a little bit to talk about on that later on. But in this job market, and to ever be able to really reasonably pay back that student loan. So that's, I don't know, I guess that's one of the big things that I had this conversation with my son. Oh, boy, let's see. It's been probably 6 months ago or so. You know, we went down, and I think I may have told this story on air, or maybe I told it on another show or something, but, you know, my son looked at a number of colleges. We unofficially visited Murray State, and Murray State is a state school, very nice school, by the way. And my son also wanted to visit Center. You know, we went down to Center, and Center is a very, very nice school, very nice campus, very customizable program as far as build your own degree type program. The problem with Center, of course, is that the tuition straight up is about $50,000 a year. Now, they'll be the first to tell you that hardly anybody actually pays that, that grants and loans and everything else. The standard tuition is closer to about $20,000. $20,000 a year is still a big chunk of change. Now, of course, that includes the ability to study abroad. I believe it's every semester except your first or maybe your freshman year. I can't remember which. But, you know, the reality is Now, my son's going into IT, and the reality is that there is no reason to study abroad for 6 semesters when you're going into IT. There's no reason to do that. And another reality is that unless you're going into something very, very specialized in IT, that a bachelor's degree from pretty much any accredited college counts the same to any employer. Certainly, there are some that'll be wowed by going to some particular school. But at the end of the day, and I work in IT, at the end of the day, really what they're interested in is, will you do the work, and not what school you went to. So it's not really a surprise to me. You get told, the kids are told, you have to go to college. You have to go to college. You have to go to college. And the reality is, I don't think you have to go to college. Certainly we don't. I don't want to say don't go to college, I guess is what I'm. The trick, I guess, is that you really have to examine, you have to do a cost-benefit analysis. And I know that's kind of a weird thing for an 18-year-old kid to do, is cost-benefit analysis. But the reality is that there's no reason to go to college for certain careers. And the careers that do make sense to go to college, there's no reason to go to a college that's going to cost $25,000, $50,000, $100,000 a year. It's really a question of, what is it that you're going into? Are you going to be in that very select field able to get a job in that very tiny niche where you can command some bucks? And even then, are you ever really reasonably going to be able to pay off that student loan? And that's, I think these are things that unfortunately we don't tell kids coming out of high school, going into college. We don't tell these folks, hey, have you really done the math on this? Are you sure you want to do this? Now, I had that conversation with my son, and of course part of that is my own motivation. My son's no dummy, and he did, thankfully, get a full-ride scholarship to Northern Kentucky University, and they do have the new IT stuff up here, the College of Informatics, and so for him, it fits perfectly. He's got it for free. It's at a school that is getting actually very wide recognition as being on the cutting edge of IT. It will be a school that is drawing in people not just from Kentucky, but around the United States, I'm sure, into that program. And it's something that, because he's got the full ride scholarship, so long as he maintains that, it's certainly worth it. Because at that point, the cost-benefit analysis is obvious. There is no cost other than time. Well, what's time to an 18-year-old? Or in my son's case, a 16-year-old. What's time to a teenager compared to the benefit of getting the degree and being able to go into the workforce with a degree? And so what we're really talking about here is dollars and cents. We're talking about, how much does it cost to get that piece of paper and then go into the workforce, and how long will it take to make up the money? What's the differential in pay for someone who has no degree versus someone who does? And do they ever catch up? When do they catch up? What's the timeline? Now, I personally did not finish college, but that was because when I was there was at the beginning of the dot-com boom. And certainly at the time, there was such a demand for skilled workers that you did not need a college degree to move on. And so I did not finish my degree. I went into the workforce, and I was able to do quite well because I was – it is a time-place thing. And, you know, honestly, at this point in my career, now, oh boy, how many years? 20 years since I graduated from high school. With this, in my point in my career, college wouldn't really matter to me as far as pay goes. And so I don't know exactly when I reached that point. I have an idea of it. I think it was probably about a decade ago. Maybe a little bit more than a decade ago. Certainly not 15 years ago. But would it have been worth going to school? And at the time I went to school, this is 20 years ago, Northern Kentucky University was just under $3,000 a year. I'm sure with books it was a little more. But $3,000 a year compared to today when it's literally three times as much. And I think that that's a pretty consistent number, that tuition over the past 20 years has tripled. Is it logical? Because our salaries, the base salaries out there haven't, I don't think, tripled in the last 20 years. But is it worth going to school, putting yourself into debt to the tune of $40,000, $50,000, and that's just the state school? And will that degree that you earn for that $40,000 or $50,000 in debt pay for itself? Now, if the answer is yes, and there are plenty of fields where the answer is yes, then do it. I mean, I'm not telling you not to do it. I'm just telling you need to look at this a little harder. But for this one-third of millennials that say it wasn't worth going to college, I almost guarantee you that they have a degree in something that doesn't end up netting you a job that pays a diddly darn. For those of you that have this degree, don't take this the wrong way, but everyone I know that had a history degree ended up working in retail. Now, don't take it the wrong way. I'm sure there's exceptions, but everyone I know that has one worked in retail. And certainly the bachelor's degree in history sets you up to move on to get another degree and whatever else. But simply going to school to get a four-year degree in history, you're going to get $40,000, $50,000 in debt. And what does that do? It means you can go possibly teach history. Well, teachers don't make jack. So the chances of you being able to pay back that money is pretty slim. What else does a history degree really prepare you for in the professional world? Not a whole lot. Now, certainly there was a time when simply having any degree was good enough, because any degree would mean that you'd gotten through college and you could do schlub through anything, and you know it would qualify you for certain jobs. But anymore, I don't see a lot of jobs with bare, plain old, hey, any college degree apply. It's very specific. So if you're going to go that route, if you're going to get the degree, which is fine, get a degree in something you can get a job in. Ask these questions ahead of time. Hey, if I get a degree in this, can I get a job in this or with this degree? What are the job prospects? How many of these people are there working? Is there a demand? You know, and certainly you want to get something that you at least have some interest in, because especially during school, whew, boy, is that boring if you're not. But you've got to do this cost-benefit analysis. You have to do this analysis to find out, can you get a job? Will a degree pay for itself? And I really believe that this one-third of millennials that regret it probably shouldn't have gone to college. I mean, obviously, they think they shouldn't have. They regret it. And, you know, what better testimony can you get than 33% of those that went to college go, man, I shouldn't have gone to college. Now, would they have done anything else? I don't know. Maybe they just wanted to sit home and play Xbox all day. I don't know. But, like I said, certainly you can make the case that one-third of the people going to college probably shouldn't. But, again, I don't want to dissuade anyone. I want to make sure, you know, and I guess for our listeners who are usually a little older than college age, you know, your kids, you need to make sure that they do the same types of calculations when it comes time for them. You need to coach them, and you need to help them understand cost-benefit analysis. And is it really worth digging yourself into this monster hole of debt? And, again, I don't want to rag on Center, but Center lets you create your own program. So if you literally wanted to create a degree of underwater basket weaving and you were intent on doing it, I'm quite sure you could get one at Center. But is the $200,000 worth of education ever going to pay for itself with underwater basket weaving? And, of course, the answer is no. So those are the kind of calculations you have to do when preparing for college. And thankfully, my son has done that, and we're very lucky that a local university is now specializing in what he wants to do and that he got a full tuition scholarship to go there. So we're obviously very happy about that. But like I said, the point is you've got to do that analysis. And, you know, despite what everyone's told, and that's, I guess, the other thing, right? Everybody says, hey, you've got to go to college. Everybody's got to go to college, got to go to college, got to go to college. This is kind of segueing into where I want to go with the show. Just because everyone says something is doesn't mean that it's the right thing for you. And this is one of the issues with a lot of modern thinking, that we all need to do whatever the majority wants to do. So, hey, for two-thirds of the kids that went to school, they don't regret it. They're glad they went, or at least neutral on it. But for one-third, they regret it. Well, we should talk about that one-third and talk about why they regret it and prevent, or hopefully prevent people from making the same mistake through their own choice. I mean, I'm not going to stop them if they insist, hey, it's your life, your money, whatever. But simply going with the pack mentality and encouraging people to do things because everybody else is doing them is the wrong way to go about things. It always has been. You know, it's those old sayings about jumping off bridges and all that stuff. So that's really where I wanted to start with the show, was to talk about this, because I think it's very important thing to look at, that, you know, this pack mentality, this, well, if it's good for the majority, then it's good for everybody mentality, is becoming very common in politics. And as certain organizations really start pushing democracy, 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 which is literally all about the majority kicking the minority around on any particular issue, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about democracy is mob rule. It's 50% plus one, you know, whatever the majority is, pushing a minority around. And that is not a recipe for individual success. Ask the minority, the one-third of students that went to college recently, that regret doing so. As individuals, the advice that, hey, college is the way to go, did not work for them. And just because government told them so, or their parents told them so, or their friends told them so, or anybody else told them so, doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. You know, we've talked on this show quite a bit in the past about smoking bans. You know, it is one of those things that's near and dear to my heart that I have fought personally here in Kentucky, and in specifically in Northern Kentucky, but also elsewhere in Kentucky. And my point has always been that we're not promoting smoking, right? Just like I'm not promoting people not go to college, I'm not promoting something that could be detrimental to someone. What I'm promoting is that individuals be allowed to choose. I'm promoting that individuals be allowed to make their own free decisions as individuals, weighing the costs and the benefits and doing that cost-benefit analysis on an individual basis with a private business. Now, a private business, yes, their doors are open to the public, but they are not public property. Public property is government-owned property. And that is a line that is getting blurred, but is tangential to the point I'm trying to make tonight. Private business decides they're going to allow smoking. Now, certainly, there are more non-smokers than smokers. Absolutely true. There's no doubt about that at all. That's just math. And depending on where you live, that number could be 80-20 or 75-25 or maybe 70-30. Those seem to be the ranges in general. Somewhere between 80% non, 20% smoking, and 70% non, 30% smoking, or about one-third, two-thirds. And again, what we're talking about here is leaving individual choices to individuals to do that cost-benefit analysis. And I'm not trying to say don't smoke. I'm not trying to say smoke. Hey, man, you do your own thing. You're an individual. You do whatever you want to do. It's cool by me, as long as you don't make me participate. Now, that last part is key, because that is what a lot of the pro-smoking ban people say is, well, hey, man, when I go into a smoking place and you're smoking next to me, you're making me smoke too. And technically, yeah, kind of right, kind of, except that they, as individuals, were the ones that walked into a smoking environment to begin with. You see, the choice, choices have consequences. Can we all agree to that? I mean, in general, when you make a choice, there's a consequence, and sometimes it's a good consequence, sometimes it's a bad. But it's just like every action has a reaction, every choice has a consequence. And sometimes we regret choices that we make, and sometimes we don't. That's okay. But if you, as an individual, walk into a smoking establishment, and then somebody smokes next to you, you can't logically complain about that. I mean, that's just asinine to say, well, this is intolerable. I walked in here and they're smoking next to me. Well, dude, this is a smoking establishment. It is not dissimilar from someone who would walk into a horse track anywhere in the state who is offended by gambling and say, well, I came in here for the food, but man, there's gambling going on here, and that's just offensive. We need a law to stop this. It's just as nonsensical. If you go into a smoking establishment and somebody smokes, you can't say I'm offended by that. Likewise, you can't be going into a gambling establishment and see people gambling and be offended by that. It's nonsensical. The choice as a consumer is always to use your own 2 feet and walk away. And in fact, one of the things that our group, had pushed hardcore as an alternative solution was labeling businesses as smoking or non-smoking, basically requiring all food service businesses to post a sign if they allow smoking. And At first, there were some people very confused by I, a libertarian, pushing such a policy. And in fact, some of the business owners were concerned. But I look at it this way. First of all, the sign costs $5. It lasts 5 years. It is $1 per year for that sign. And right there and then, at a cost of $1 per year, the business owners that had said, oh, wait, I don't know about this, immediately said, oh, okay, then I don't care. It sounds good. And in fact, we had a couple of business owners that said, you know what, this is a good idea, and in fact, I might just go ahead and post a sign, because I've always dealt with these jerk customers that come in knowing it's a smoking establishment, sit down next to a smoker, and then after they finish eating, demand their meal free because they were exposed to smoke. And yes, folks, that does happen. And again, you know, those business owners have to explain, hey, man, you walked in here voluntarily. You knew what it was when you came in, and you can't claim after you've been served and consumed the food, now you're offended. Right? I mean, that's logic, right? Everybody agree? That's pretty logical. And it's no different than college. And maybe we need a warning label for college. Maybe it needs to be warning. Racking up $100,000 worth of debt on a history degree is a really stupid idea. Is that what we need? I don't know. In some ways, I almost feel like we do. These colleges and society itself pressures these kids into going into fields where they're never going to make any money and rack up a whole bunch of debt doing it. And at least if there was something where they had to, like, you know, sign something that says, I realize that I am a moron and I am going to spend $200,000 to get me a degree that's going to make me $20,000 a year for the rest of my life. And put it in that terms, maybe that's a little extreme, but it's frustrating because these kids have no idea. They haven't been in the job market. They have no concept of what it is to even live on their own. No warnings, no protections. And I will say that these colleges, by offering these programs without warning, hey, you're not going to make any money doing this, are damn near predatory. Now, certainly you could argue, well, you know, it's free choice. We can do, you know, with the people are willing to pay, and so we'll offer it. Yeah, but these kids don't know any better. They just don't know any better. And I'm not a big government guy. You know, the people who listen to this show regularly know that. But damn, informing people of what they're about to do, still giving them the option to do it. I mean, hey, man, if you want to go do it, cool. Whatever you want to do, that's awesome. And if you've thought it through and you've got some plan where, oh, yeah, well, I'm going to get the history degree, but then that's going to get me to this degree, and then I'm going to get a job making 150 Gs, hey, okay, cool, I don't care. If you've got a plan and you know what you're doing and whatever, cool. Fine by me. But to let kids blindly walk into $100,000 in debt at the very start of their lives and burden these kids with a debt that cannot be removed, even through bankruptcy, is essentially enslaving these kids to the federal government, because the federal government now owns all the loans, enslaving these kids to the federal government. To the point where they're going to work for how many years to pay off that student loan? I mean, if you don't get a good paying job and you've got $40,000 or $50,000 in debt, even at a 4 or 5, even 6%, 6, 5, 4, you know, whatever percentage rate, it's going to take a long time. A decade? 2 decades? It's going to take a very long time to pay off that debt. And nobody talks to these kids about that. Maybe that's what it needs to be. Maybe it's the student loan administrators should be required to explain this stuff and ask, hey, what field are you going into? And based on that field, your average salary is going to be this, and it's going to take you 30 years to pay this off. You're going to be damn near ready to collect Social Security before you're going to have this thing paid off. As if Social Security is going to be there, but that's another story for a different day. Maybe that's the conversation that needs to be had. I don't know. It just seems like somewhere somebody has to inform the consumer of what they're about to consume, right? I mean, if they don't know, how can they ever know? I mean, who are these kids? They're 18 years old. They don't know any better. Yeah, they're legal adults, but they have no real-world experience at all. So I'm going to take a break. We're past the bottom of the hour. And I'm here at the new location of the show, at least the new temporary location. I can't smoke while I'm doing the show, and when I get worked up, I'd like to have a cigarette, and I can't. And that's just a bummer for me. So we're going to take a break here. When we come back, we're going to tie this in to some of the other things, and, of course, the big fight on genetically modified foods is back yet again. We'll touch on that as well because, you know, it all in some way ties together. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue. You are listening to Liberty Unbridled on the My View Matters Radio Network. Back in a few minutes.
Being a victim of crime is no joke, but you do have options that can help you avoid becoming a victim. I'm Ed Springson of the My View Matters radio show, and on behalf of myself and co-host Ed Martin, I urge each of you to help us fight against crime. You can do your part by calling Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE. Since 1982, Crime Stoppers has helped get over 23,000 criminals off the street with your help. Working together, we can make a difference to take our streets back. Please call Crime Stoppers at 582-CLUE, or you can visit them online at www.582clue.com. Remember, Crime Stoppers always offers up to a $1,000 reward. Get involved and help make a positive change in your neighborhood. Thanks.
Advertisers, here's a great way to reach a quality audience. Get heard on My View Matters and make some noise in the marketplace.
Email myviewmatters@aol.com for advertising opportunities. Make a sound investment.
So I wanted to mention real quick, next week, I tried to set up an interview this week with Brandon Simpson. He's the author of a new book called The Libertarian Lessons of South Park. And unfortunately, we couldn't make our schedules jive this week. As mentioned, my son graduating from high school, really, this week has flown by between that and my actual real work that I do. Did not have time to hook up with him, and we're hoping to have him on the show next week. I think that it's an interesting concept to try to find libertarian lessons in various things, and so we'll have that hopefully for you next week if we can get the logistics worked out. So getting back to it here, we were talking about labeling and student debts and restaurants and that, but one of the things that, and we had a whole show dedicated to this, talking about the two sides and everything else, but one of the big arguments that's out there and one of the raging debates about labeling is the genetically modified food. And, where I'm at on it is, you know what, if you want to grow it, fine, grow it. If you want to use it in your stuff, fine, use it. But I think it is only fair to label that food or that product as such. Now, most of our food has an ingredients list today. Consumer labeling laws that came in, I think those were in the 80s. It seems like it was the 80s. Requiring the labeling of what is in a food product is a good thing. I, as a consumer, appreciate that. And it lets me, as a consumer, make better choices. You know, I talked about it when we had the show about how I love eggnog until I realized, you know, wow, there's a lot of fat in eggnog. And those of you that have met me or see me online or whatever know that I'm not a skinny person. I'm not, Mack truck or anything, but I'm not skinny. And, it's something that I'm not intentionally seeking to make myself a barge. So, as much as I do enjoy eggnog, upon learning the information, and it had been there for quite some time, but once I finally actually did look at the information, realized, I should probably slow down on the old eggnog. Likewise, I am extraordinarily sensitive to aspartame. Cannot stand the taste of aspartame. And the food labeling allows me to see that, hey, this product contains aspartame. I don't want to purchase it because I do not want to consume it because I despise aspartame. And there are lots of other little examples. I don't like coconut, so I don't buy stuff that has coconut in it. Consumer labeling can work and should work when it is unreasonable to otherwise know. And I guess that's kind of what this whole thing gets to. The kid entering college has no concept of the decision that they're about to make. There's no way that they can make that rational choice because they have no frame of reference from which to make it. In a restaurant, in order to find out, you either have to dig up a phone number and call ahead and hope you get somebody that tells you the truth and all that, or walk into the restaurant and ask someone after being exposed to what is overblown, but whatever, the dangers of smoke. But the point is that it should be easier for consumers to make consumer decisions, to make educated consumer decisions. And certainly in the case of eggnog, right? If I go somewhere and someone's made homemade eggnog, I can say, hey, man, what was in that? What'd you make? What's in it? And they can tell me because they produced it, right? I'm one step away from the producer. And I can ask the producer, hey, what's in this? But when you get multiple steps away from the actual producer of the material, it becomes infinitely harder with every step to find out what is actually in it. I've used this analogy tons of times, cornflakes. Now, if there's a concern that cornflakes has GMO corn in it, and I don't know if there is or not, I wish I'd followed a little closer, but the reality is that I can't say, oh, I'm hungry, I'm going to go to the store, see a box on the shelf, write down the lot number, call Kellogg's, ask to speak to someone who would know, or to leave a message for them, give them a lot number, and say, hey, man, what was in the corn that you used in the cornflakes in lot number, blah, 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 and wait for a response before purchasing the product. It's just not reasonable. It's too many steps removed. And my guess is that Kellogg's probably has no idea if it's GMO corn or not. They probably just don't know. And today, there's no regulation to say whether they need to know or not. So why care? It's just an extra thing to know that doesn't really benefit their business one way or the other. If they're going to be nonchalant about it, then who cares? They don't know. They don't care. I don't know. So there's a big difference, right? I mean, you can go to a local farm and talk to the farmer before you buy a product. You can go to a local food place and talk to them before purchasing the food. But when you buy food that is a list of ingredients that has been put together somewhere, sent to a distributor, the distributor then sends it out to the stores, and the stores are trying to sell it to you, well, nobody in a dang store has any freaking clue what's in that stuff. They don't know. Go to Walmart, go to any grocery store, go to a Kroger, go anywhere. Pick up a box of whatever that contains corn and find somebody in that store that knows whether or not it's GMO corn or not. There isn't anyone. It's completely removed from the store. They have no idea. None. And why would they? They're so far removed from the production process, they have no clue. And that's why I'm an advocate for labeling in that scenario. Not for all food, but for things that are multiple lines down the distribution chain. Things that it is unreasonable to ask the seller about. Kroger's has no idea if it's GMO corn. But if I go to the farm and I say, hey, what kind of corn is this? Is it GMO or not? Yes or no? I can ask the farmer. They know. They know what they bought when they seeded it. They know. And so the argument against this now, and this is the ironic thing, I guess, the argument that's being used now is, well, you know, if you use government-mandated labels, then all these big companies will just manipulate the law and make it so they get exemptions. Well, you know, folks, that happens today. I assume you've all seen where they're trying to change the requirements for milk to basically be allowed to define milk as milk plus aspartame, which, again, big thing for me. I can't stand the taste of aspartame. But the idea is to create a healthier milk that kids will drink, so that they will get vitamins and nutrients. Well, you know, I don't like aspartame. And milk plus aspartame is not the same thing as milk. And certainly you should not be allowed to label something that is something plus something as just one of those things. Because it's not one of those things. It's a list of ingredients. I've got a good friend of mine that, according to his doctor anyway, was for whatever reason sensitive to some of this GMO corn. And now, because nobody labels GMO or not, he can't eat anything with corn in it because it may be GMO. And apparently there's some strain of GMO corn that he's got some sort of hypersensitivity to. I don't know all the details of it. I just know that he was complaining about it because now he can't eat corn at all unless he goes to a farm and talks to a farmer and gets corn from that farmer, which is fine if you just want corn, but not so good if you want something made from corn. It's very difficult or burdensome to deal with. And it's something that could be easily solved with labeling, because labeling would inform consumers. And labeling would create a niche market. If no one is producing something with no GMO corn, then certainly someone will see an opportunity to say, hey, no GMO corn here, and label it as such. And I certainly understand the idea that government is corrupting on this. I mean, I'm pretty sure I've told the story on the show in the past about Creekstone and the butcher operation that they had for cattle, and how they were specifically prevented from testing every head of cattle that they had for mad cow disease during our mad cow scare, you know, a decade or so ago. And certainly that's bad. And we should fight that. And we should raise a ruckus over that, because that is a government bureaucracy run wild protecting big business. Certainly we should be protesting that. But just because government does work with big business, conspires with big business to do things to keep the little guy down or to specifically stifle a free market solution in that scenario, doesn't mean that it can't be used all the time. And certainly, you know, just like I do, I preach this Creekstone story. It's been over a decade, I bet, since that happened. But I still preach it because it is damaging to those bureaucracies that cause such things. And certainly it's not the only instance. We see bureaucracies being damaged by their own stupidity all the time. You know, this big IRS scandal that's out there now with the 501c organizations and the Tea Parties and 912 groups and anything labeled Patriot Group and all this different stuff. Certainly, there was some targeting going on there. And they're getting, justifiably so, smacked around for it because they were not treating people with equal protection. And that's to be expected. And, of course, like I said, the IRS is taking a pounding on this in the public eye. And that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. You know, we need to hold our government accountable. But just because government fails us from time to time does not mean that government has no role at all. I am not an anarchist. I have repeated that on this show multiple times. I do believe that there is a role for government. It is small and it is limited, but it is important. Our founders understood that in this country. They knew that there is a delicate balance between tyranny and liberty and a need for government and the government's propensity to grow and to take from us and to oppress us. And that it is our job to deal with that balancing act. That is what we're talking about here. We need to have the ability to be empowered. Government should never take from us. How do I say that? Government shouldn't be in the business of oppressing us. And then I've mentioned I work for the Libertarian Party, and I've mentioned this before. You know, when I helped draft the model by which the Libertarian Party of Kentucky runs in this state, we are built as a bottom-up organization with most of the power made local, and the next levels up work only as a check and balance against the local levels, because it is important to have checks and balances at every level, and to help between other boundaries. So if there's a political race running between two counties, certainly there's a place for a district organization, a congressional district organization, to step in and assist. Or in the case of a statewide campaign, there's certainly a place for a state party to step in and help coordinate amongst the districts and the counties that are operating in that regard. Likewise, government's no different. Government should be letting decisions be made locally. Government should, at the next level up, be working solely as a check and balance. In case a local government begins oppressing its people, they should have the power to step in and say, you cannot do that. And they should, when two communities are trying to work together, be there to help facilitate that orchestration of those two communities that are working together for mutual benefit. It should be beneficial. I guess for me, I understand the principle of not forcing a business to label its product, that it's, oh, it's up to the consumer. I understand that in principle. But I also understand that what that means is that we end up in a caveat emptor society, buyer beware, putting all the accountability on the buyer and none upon the seller. Well, that creates an imbalance. It creates a power situation where the seller has no recourse, or there's no negative, there's no punishment for a seller acting unscrupulously, and puts the entire onus on the buyer. That is not a balanced relationship. You're encouraging fraud. If a seller can say anything to sell their product and it's up to the buyer to decipher what's true or not, then you're encouraging the sellers to do whatever possible, to be fraudulent, to lie, to cheat, to steal. I don't want to live in a society where people are encouraged to lie, cheat, and steal to me. I don't want that. And you don't either. Raise your hand if you want to be lied to today. I mean, really? Of course you don't. No one does. We don't need fraud. We don't need lies. What we need is a system that is balanced, that balances responsibilities between the buyer and the seller. It is up to the seller to disclose or to make available the information about their product to the buyer. The buyer, who has money, who wants the product, needs to have that information to know whether it's worth trading their dollars for that product. The seller has a product and they want your money. The buyer has money and they want your product. That is a symbiotic relationship. It's a free individual association relationship. And certainly if there's something with the product that you don't like, the buyer has the ability to walk away. Or if the seller doesn't like the price the buyer is willing to pay, the seller is under no obligation to sell. But until you even know what is being sold, how can you, the buyer, even know if it's worth the money you're willing to pay? There is no way to know if there is no accountability upon the seller to tell you. And again, as a farmer, I can walk up to a farmer and say, hey, man, where you keep your chickens? I'd like to see how the condition of your chickens. That's legit. It's a legit question. But I can't go to Tyson Foods and say, hey, I want to tour the plant where this bag of chicken, this lot of chicken, that I have and this bag of frozen chicken. I want to see exactly how those particular chickens lived. They have no idea probably even where those chickens came from. Well, they probably have some because of the whole tracking stuff with outbreaks. But the reality is they have no incentive to show you anyway. It would cost them a fortune. They're not going to do it. They're just not going to do it. So in the case of chickens, I'd like to know, and some of them have started marketing as hormone-free, but what's hormone-free? I mean, there were people that for years now have been using that human growth hormone, which is basically testosterone, but have been saying that that's not a performance-enhancing drug. And they were skirting around the laws on that stuff. There's always going to be people trying to cheat the system. Sure, there will be. But what we can do to level the playing field is that when it is impossible to have a face-to-face conversation with the seller of a product, that the information that a buyer would reasonably need to know, which is a list of ingredients of that product, that should be listed on the product. It's straightforward. It's low cost. It costs the companies almost nothing to print the ingredients on the back of a box or on the side of a box. It's not even prime real estate, but it's there in case you want it. That's not a bad thing. It's a good thing because it empowers you and I as consumers to make better choices. And when you and I and your neighbors make better choices, not by force, but because we're able to do so, when we choose products, the market's better. We get higher quality products based on, and quality defined by what consumers demand. And you know what? There might be plenty of consumers that just say, you know what? I don't care about GMO. I just want the lowest price. Well, cool, man. Do it. That was the reason they gave to block Creekstone, was they were afraid that, well, people would demand all their meat be tested. Well, that's a bad thing. I mean, you know what? It might cost more, but if it's what people demand, it's what they demand. And I'm quickly running out of time, and the sound isn't working right. So, folks, I'm going to wrap it up for the week. But the point is, labels inform consumers to become better consumers, creates a better free market. It's not detrimental to a market to label when it is unreasonable to otherwise ask what's in a product. Folks, y'all have a good week. We'll see you next week on another edition of Liberty Unbridled on the MyView Matters Radio Network.